Good morning. I'm Jennifer Bissett. I represent Rebecca Leonard, and she's here with me this morning. This is my first time down here, and I have to say, this courthouse is fantastic. You must be thrilled.
We are.
And it sure beats the place over in Colfax. I would like to focus on what I think is the central issue to this appeal that controls the issue of costs, which is the 1317-202 statute, and specifically with respect to the plaintiff's offer of settlement. In my view, there are different standards for a plaintiff's offer of settlement and a defendant's offer of settlement. But in any event, it's clear that the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court have determined that the way you decide whether the offer is successful has to do with the terms of the offer itself. So where we start is, did the plaintiff receive a final judgment in excess of her offer of settlement? And then she is to be awarded actual costs. How do we determine that the plaintiff succeeded on her offer of settlement? Well, there's several components. The first one is the verdict itself. The second is prejudgment interest. The only limitation on that is interest that accrues post-offer. Where this case went sideways is that the trial court imposed an additional requirement, which is that she also had to have pre-offer costs that brought her up to the offer of settlement. That's not required by the statute. As I went through all the cases that have to do with offers of settlement, the vast majority have to do with the defendant's offer of settlement, where then costs accrued may be relevant. But that provision in the statute was actually taken out in 1995. I attached as an appendix to the plaintiff's opening brief the legislative history on this statute. So where this case went sideways is that the trial court decided that plaintiff had to prove that her then costs accrued as of the time of her offer controlled whether she was successful. The statute doesn't call for that. The statute says final judgment. So when we look at that, when
well,
we take...
the statute for plaintiff and the statute for defendant are admittedly different, correct?
They are.
All right. The plaintiff statute says final judgment has to be in excess of the amount offered.
Right.
The judge did add in to the jury's verdict for the plaintiff pre-offer costs, correct? Which the statute doesn't specifically provide for. It does on the defendant's part of it, but doesn't for the plaintiff, as I read it.
That's right, it doesn't.
So we added to her amount of judgment to see if it would get to the, if I'm not mistaken, 350 was your offer of settlement.
350 was the offer of settlement. And what I'm saying, Judge, is that what controls here are the terms of the plaintiff's offer of settlement. That's what the case law says. So you have to look at the terms of the plaintiff's offer of settlement. Her offer was all legal, all legal claims asserted in this action. It doesn't say anything in her offer of settlement that included then costs accrued. The defendant's offer of settlement states that, but not the plaintiff's. Well, it's the plaintiff's offer of settlement that controls.
Right,
there's no limitation in there about then costs accrued.
But there was no question the verdict of the jury was, I forget the number exactly, but it was less than the amount of the settlement offer that plaintiff had made, correct?
We're looking at final judgment, Your Honor. It's not just the verdict. The final judgment is the verdict plus prejudgment interest up to the date of the offer. And then we look at the terms of the offer of settlement, which is all legal claims. So that includes all claims. There's a case on that. It's Bumble versus Smith that talks about what all claims means. It's all inclusive and includes costs. The only exclusion, the only statutory exclusion is post-offer prejudgment interest. So if we look at the final judgment here, the judge calculated prejudgment interest up to the date of the offer at 331. Then he awarded $32,000, almost $33,000 in costs. That puts plaintiff's actual judgment, her final judgment, above her offer. It's not controlled by her pre-offer costs. That's where the court erred.
What is the authority? Your position, if I understand it, is that the judge erred by not adding to the jury's verdict 100% of what you say her costs were. That's your position, right? It should have added total costs.
I agree.
Okay. The statute doesn't say anything about adding costs. in the plaintiff's part of the statute, it does say that in the defendant's part of the statute. So what's your authority that for the position you take, that total costs, in addition to the jury's verdict, should be added when comparing the plaintiff's judgment to the actual, the judgment amount to the settlement offer? What is the authority for adding total costs as opposed to just pre-offer costs, is what I'm asking.
As I read the cases and the Supreme Court decision, Centric Jones versus Huffnagel,
okay,
that you decide whether the plaintiff has succeeded on her offer settlement based on the terms of her offer. What happened here is they based it on the terms of the defendant's offer. They're distinct. The defendant's offer made an offer saying all costs and interest accrued and attorney fees as of their date of their offer. But that doesn't apply to the plaintiff's offer of settlement. The terms of her offer are all inclusive. So that's where you get the terms here, is from the plaintiff's offer of settlement.
Pardon me, Ms. Bissett.
Yes, sir.
But I'm wondering which way that argument cuts. Because if the statute, as Judge Richmond points out, says yes for defense but is silent as to plaintiff, doesn't that suggest that the legislature has made a conscious decision not to include those costs?
I don't see where that is expressed in the statute, Your Honor.
Well, as I said, if the legislature has said that for the defense, in the defense statute, it specifically refers to costs, but it is silent as to costs for the plaintiff, doesn't that suggest a conscious legislative decision?
Your Honor, I disagree with that, your interpretation of the statute, because the language, then costs accrued, only applied to defendant's offer of settlement, and that language came out of the statute in 1995 by amendment. So the only thing that's been revised, I mean, the way these offers of settlement, the statute reads, is pretty much identical for plaintiff's offer and defendant's offer. It's not limited by what costs you accrued as of the date of the offer. The only change that happened, and this was in response to the Bennett v. Hickman case, is in the defendant's offer of settlement, if the plaintiff is a prevailing party, plaintiff's final judgment includes the amount of her actual costs that accrued prior to the offer of settlement. But that was in 2008 that got added. That's really the only distinction in these statutes. And that was as a result of, if plaintiff's a prevailing party, she didn't get any costs. So my position is, the statute doesn't tell us here that you have to look at this from the standpoint of then costs accrued. That language came out of the statute. It's not included in plaintiff's offer. You have to make this decision based on the terms of the plaintiff's offer. So even if we look at the final judgment under the trial court's award, he gave her $33,000 in costs, which clearly puts her above her offer of settlement. She was successful. If she's successful on her offer of settlement, it doesn't matter that the defendant was a prevailing party on the bad faith case, because they are facing more liability than they would have if they had accepted the plaintiff's offer. So that means that even if they're the prevailing party, they don't get an award of costs. So their award of costs needs to be subtracted out from this case. The next question has to do with, how did the court go about awarding costs?
Well, you're now shifting gears on us, I take it. You're now saying that defendants should not have been awarded costs because they did not receive, or the verdict was not less than their settlement offer?
No. This gets really confusing, because there's a defendant's settlement, offers of settlement, and there's plaintiff's offer of settlement.
Yes, and the verdict fell in between, which is what makes this very somewhat different. Nobody really prevailed on their settlement offer.
Well, I disagree, Judge. I believe that plaintiff prevailed on hers. And the reason that I believe plaintiff prevailed on hers is because her offer of settlement is legal claims. And there's no limitation on that.
Right.
The cases, there's the most recent case that was decided on a plaintiff's offer of settlement is 2009, Caitlin versus Tormey Bewley Corporation. And that case doesn't help us, because they don't put in here the terms of the plaintiff's offer settlement.
Ms. Bissett,
go ahead.
Pardon me. I want to ask you a hypothetical question. So we're stepping away from your argument that indeed there was success for you. I want to go to Judge Richman's point about this midpoint between the offer of the plaintiff and the offer of the defendant. All right? Let us assume a hypothetical where there is an offer of the plaintiff and the verdict comes in, and however you calculate it, it's less, but it is greater than the offer of the defendant. What should we do in that situation?
I'm confused by your hypothetical, Judge.
Well, okay. Let's say that the plaintiff offers $350,000. And assume for the purposes of this hypothetical that the defense offers $200,000. And assume that without any disagreement over calculation, that the plaintiff recovers $275,000. What do we do?
Well, you have to look at the final judgment. That's what the statute...
Let's assume that's it. $275,000.
Well, Judge, you're missing a couple steps here because pre-offer interest is relevant.
Let's assume that's the final figure. That all the things that you would normally put into it reach this $275,000 level. What do we do then?
Well, then I think it becomes... The case on that is Hall versus Frank, where they talk about if the plaintiff makes an offer of settlement, doesn't receive an award that's equal to her offer of settlement, she's still entitled to costs as a prevailing party.
Which is what the judge did here.
And I disagree with how the judge arrived at his conclusion, because I don't think her pre-offer costs are relevant. It's the final judgment. What does the statute say? The plaintiff recovers a final judgment in excess of the amount offered.
But that begs the question of what the final judgment is.
Well, that's...
And it's almost like you're saying the court has to calculate some kind of preliminary hypothetical final judgment to determine whether the final judgment would exceed the offer if costs were awarded. And if that preliminary hypothetical number would exceed it, then we will award the number. I mean, that's what you're saying.
Judge, I understand that this statute poses a problem in terms of how do you determine what's the plaintiff's final judgment, because the only definition of a final judgment in the statute excludes post-offer interest. It doesn't exclude anything else. So let's just say we take a look at this case and what the judge did. He added the pre-offer interest to the verdict, mm-hmm. and then he awarded costs. That combination gives a plaintiff a final judgment in excess of her offer.
Well,
so she's successful.
You say he awarded costs.
He did.
But then you...
He did.
Ultimately, he did, but what I'm saying is he included pre-offer costs.
That's wrong.
I know you're saying that's wrong, and I'm trying to figure out why the judge has to go through this kind of mind exercise in determining what the final judgment is for purposes of this statute, where we're just kind of hypothesizing. You give the judge a bill of costs, and you say it's $120,000. Okay. Now the judge, typically, he would analyze that in determining what to award you. Okay. You're saying he doesn't really do that here. He analyzes that. He looks at that and says, "Oh well, they're claiming $118,000 in costs. If I award that, they'll be over $350,000.
Easily.
But what if he decides you're only entitled to $20,000 in costs or $30,000?
Well, let's take a look at what he actually did do. The costs that he subtracted out were on the breach of the bad faith claims. That was pretty much, as you look through his order, he just says, okay, well, she didn't win on the bad faith claim, so I'm not going to give her any costs on that. But if she has achieved a final judgment and she's entitled to a final judgment in excess of her offer, she gets all her costs. There's no exclusion for claims that you didn't win.
But here, this is a cart before the horse argument. Typically, in fact, as far as I know, always, the court determines whether you're entitled to costs first before awarding costs, before determining what those costs are. There is a liability determination before there is a damages determination, to put it in other terms.
So,
and you're saying we reverse it here.
Well,
we make a damages determination, that is a cost determination, and then if that gets us over a number, then we do a liability determination.
What I'm suggesting to you, Judge, is that the statute and the case law in this case already informed the court as to how this should go. which is it's controlled by the plaintiff's offer of settlement. That how you determine the success is based on our offer of settlement. In this case, it includes all legal claims. All legal claims includes costs. Those cases have been decided. Bumble versus Smith is one. There's an older one that decide and define what all legal claims include, and it includes costs. So I'm just about out of time. I was really hoping to reserve 5 minutes, and I had other things to say, and this went really fast.
Let me ask you a question before I sit down, though, please.
Please.
Can you tell us if this policy was issued after January 1st, 2008, and I'm addressing the $25,000 set-off claim that the defendant's making?
You know, I have
the accident occurred in July of 2008. Was this a policy that was issued after January 2008 so that the new statute applied?
I can answer that by supplement, but I can't tell you off the top of my head.
Okay, thank you.
I know that the policy was admitted into evidence, and I can't tell you. Okay. I think it might have been March of 2008.
Thank you, counsel.
Your Honors, may it please the court. My name is Thomas Seaman, and I'm with the law firm Seaman & Chambers, and we represent the appellant, or appellee and cross-appellant State Farm in this case. Let me address your question, Judge Richman, since it's fresh on my mind. The policy was issued after January 1 of 2008. The accident occurred, I think, in the summer of 2008. Policies are issued on a six-month basis. That issue actually came up, and there's some reference to it in the briefing in terms of cross-examination of a plaintiff's insurance expert who claimed that the policy in this case, or that the coverage in this case under the State Farm policy would be reduced by $25,000 because of the liability coverage. And I cross-examined the expert. His name is Charles Miller on that point. Simply to point out or demonstrate to the jury that Mr. Miller was not familiar with Colorado law or the law that applied to this case.
Well, as long as you've opened this subject, if I understand what you're saying, you tried to demonstrate to Mr. Miller that there is no $25,000 set off.
That's not what I just said, Your Honor. You have to draw a distinction or understand the distinction between coverage and benefits. So what Miller was saying was that the coverage under the State Farm policy, which had been $350,000, was reduced to $325,000. That's the only, those are the new limits of coverage because of the liability coverage under the liability policy. And after January 1 of 2008, coverage was not reduced or cannot be reduced by the amount of the liability coverage, but the benefits that are owed.
When you say the liability, you're talking about the tortfeasor's liability.
Right, tortfeasor's liability.
I know that's a language. Okay. Yeah. Therefore, it's not reduced by that. Okay, go ahead.
What we're talking about in terms of benefits is how much money is the plaintiff entitled to receive as compensation for damages. And that is reduced by the $25,000. Her damages are her damages. And if $25,000 of her damages are paid by liability insurance, then State Farm is not required to, again, pay that same $25,000. Its coverage remains at $350,000, but if $25,000 is paid, then her damages are reduced by $25,000. If $100,000 is paid, her damages that are recoverable from UIM or underinsured motorist coverage are reduced by $100,000. We're talking about the difference between benefits and coverage limits.
So the difference now is, of course, there's no set off in terms of the coverage, and the coverage is now stacked on top of what the
exactly
the injured party recovers from the tortfeasor.
Exactly. Right. But the recovery from the tortfeasor remains relevant because it goes to the issue of what are the damages that were sustained that have been uncompensated for this particular insured. That they don't get to collect the $25,000 in this case in liability and pretend that it didn't exist and then start from dollar one in terms of collecting damages under the UIM coverage.
Well, but what were the damages claimed in the case against your client, though? It's a claim under the policy. So it's not the equivalent necessary of what the damages were for the incident. You see what I'm saying?
It's measured by the damages.
No, it's measured by the damages less the $25,000.
Well, actually, the policy language says that the UIM coverage pays for damages that the insured would have been legally entitled to recover from the tortfeasor had the tortfeasor been adequately insured.
All right, so that's
so still the starting point is damages. How much damages were caused by the tortfeasor's negligence? And the fact that there was $25,000 in coverage doesn't reduce the UIM coverage, which it used to before January 1 of 2008. It used to have a set-off that actually reduced the coverage, so the maximum exposure would have reduced to $325 from $350. That was no longer true after January 1 of 2008.
Right, but I guess my point is the damages are, in this case, are the amount of coverage that should have been provided after the $25,000.
The maximum, if I understand your question, Judge, the maximum amount of underinsured motorist benefits that could have been recovered would have been $350,000.
Yes, that was the maximum. But yes. So if the damages were, let's pick a figure, if the actual damages for the incident were $350,000, then your position would be that damages against your client would be limited to $325.
We owe $325. The other $25 is paid by the liability carrier.
Okay.
Even though the statute says the amount of coverage available shall not be reduced by a set-off from any other coverage.
Key language being coverage in that sentence, Your Honor. The amount of coverage shall not be reduced by the set-off for liability coverage. So in other words, the $350,000, and that didn't used to be true. That used to be that if there was liability coverage for the tortfeasor with $25 or $100 whatever, the actual amount of the UIM coverage would be reduced. And in some cases, it was reduced to zero. I mean, if you had $100,000 in liability coverage and $100,000 in U coverage, the setoff would mean that you had no U coverage. After January 1, that you could stack the U coverage on top of that liability coverage.
I don't understand your position. I'm sorry if I'm dense, but I don't understand how, if the sentence says it shall not be reduced by a setoff from any other coverage, and I agree with what you say, before the statute was amended, it did what you did. What does that mean here? What does that mean in any case if it's not reduced by setoff? It seems like here the coverage was $350. It's not reduced by the $25,000 the tortfeasor paid. The judge capped the damages at $350, right?
Or no. Well,
he reduced it down to $350 when it got over $350.
Right.
And you're arguing for an additional $25,000 setoff, which seems to me to be inconsistent with the statute.
Not at all, Your Honor. And again, it goes back to the difference between coverage and the amount of damages. What we're saying is that the jury was asked to return a verdict, special verdict form, answering questions as to what the total damages were caused by the tortfeasor's negligence in three categories. Same three categories that are addressed in a third-party case.
Well, do we have a collateral source problem in terms of the setoff that you're asking for?
I don't think it is a collateral source problem. I don't.
It's coming from other insurance that's paid for by somebody, so that's not a collateral
source.
Well,
if you look at 10-4-609, which is the uninsured, underinsured motorist statute, it defines what an insured is entitled to receive under uninsured or underinsured motorist coverage. And it's really, it's an excess coverage. In the case of UIM, it's an excess coverage over the amount of liability coverage that is available and payable to that plaintiff. So it's a little bit different situation, and it's covered by a specific statute, 10-4-609, which recognizes that there will be, in some instances, and I'm talking about the underinsured case, obviously, and not the uninsured case. In the underinsured case, there's a recognition that there's going to be liability coverage that are going to pay part of the damages incurred by an insured, and what they're entitled to recover then from the underinsured carrier are the excess damages over and above.
Right.
And after January 1 of 2008, that coverage isn't reduced any longer by the amount of the liability coverage.
Right. All right, let's shift gears and get back to this issue that we spent 15 minutes on just a little while ago. And I think the crux of this really is, what does final judgment mean? It's not a defined term in this statute, but elsewhere, a final judgment is deemed to be a judgment that includes costs. I mean, if there's not an award of costs and somebody tries to appeal a judgment, we send it back because we say you don't have a final judgment yet. So why doesn't the final judgment here include all the costs that were incurred by the plaintiff?
I think, Your Honor, I believe that the trial court correctly applied the law, and specifically the case law in the Rubio versus Ferris case, and Rubio relied on the Chartier versus Wineland Homes case. And what the trial court in this case did, first of all, they treated the offer of settlement by plaintiff the same as they would treat an offer of settlement by defendant in terms of calculating the amount of the judgment that's to be compared with the offer of settlement. And that's consistent with Rubio, because one of the arguments in Rubio by the plaintiff in that case was that the 1317-202 was unconstitutional because it didn't provide equal protection to plaintiffs. The argument was that plaintiffs got the short end of the stick in terms of offer of settlement. One of the things that the Court of Appeals decided in Rubio was because 1317-202 provides equal opportunity and risk to plaintiffs and defendants alike, it doesn't violate equal protection principles. So the court in Rubio looked at the statute and said, we're going to apply the statute across the board in an even-handed manner. And that even-handed manner, according to Rubio and the Chartier case, say you take the verdict amount before there's an entry of judgment on that verdict. You add to that pre-offer costs, and you add to that pre-offer pre-judgment interest. Combination of those three factors, then you come up with a total. You compare that to the offer of settlement, and if it's greater than the offer of settlement, then you beat the offer of settlement. If it's less, then you have it. And I think that in this case, Judge Hood correctly applied Rubio in reaching that result. You're right, it requires the trial court to do some mathematical computation that it otherwise wouldn't do, because you're not typically, as a trial judge, considering the costs award at that point in time at all. But for purposes, when you've got a case with an offer of settlement, in this case multiple offers of settlement, it's necessary to do that math so that you've got a basis to do that comparison. And I think Rubio provides that answer. Now, the plaintiffs have cited one case in the whole country out of California, the Stallman case, where a court 20 years ago in California, an intermediate court, said that you apply or you add to the judgment or verdict amount all of the plaintiff's costs and not just the pre-offer costs. But I think the approach in Colorado under Rubio and the Chartier case is the approach that has been typically followed by trial courts and appellate courts in this case.
Pardon me, Mr. Seaman.
I'm sorry?
Pardon me.
Okay.
I'd like to ask you my hypothetical, the one that I asked Ms. Bissett. What do you have when you have an offer of settlement from the plaintiff and the judgment, and let's say you've got the entire calculation, the judgment comes in less than that, but it comes in greater than the offer of settlement from defense?
I think the offer of settlement from the defense is not relevant in that situation if the court, as the court did in this case, finds that the defendant is a prevailing party. I think the defendant's offers of settlement, there were two of them in this case, mm-hmm. and the judgment that was entered was higher than both of them. If State Farm were relying simply on 1317-202, they would lose on the issue of cost because the offers of settlement were less than the amount of the eventual judgment on the contract mm-hmm. claim. The reason that State Farm is entitled to a recovery of costs in this case is based upon the Archer case. And the court in this case did an Archer analysis, which it was required to do, and it concluded from that State Farm, as well as the plaintiff, was a prevailing party. And it went through the detail that's required in Archer in reaching that conclusion. So the fact that there is a judgment entered for more than State Farm's offers of settlement really doesn't matter in terms of an award of cost if the award is based upon State Farm being found to be a prevailing party.
So your position is that Archer trumps the simple application of the two statutes that I had in my hypothetical?
I think that Archer can exist side by side with those statutes. I think that Archer says that if you're Archer says, and actually the same is true, if you're a plaintiff and a prevailing party, you're entitled to an award of costs as a prevailing party. All we're saying in the defense mode in this case, if you will, based on Archer, is it's once State Farm is determined to be a prevailing party, based upon a correct application of Archer, then it's entitled to an award, in this case, of some of its costs, not all of its costs. And I think the trial court approached it correctly and in an even-handed manner by saying, we're going to award some cost to State Farm for its defense of the extra contractual claims, the bad faith and the statutory claim. We're going to deny other costs claimed by State Farm. We're going to do the same thing with the plaintiff as far as awarding plaintiff costs on those, on the claim, the contract claim the plaintiff conceded or succeeded on, and deny plaintiff those costs on the claims that they were unsuccessful. Archer allows that to take place, provided that the trial court makes adequate findings under Archer, which in this case was done. There was no challenge by the appellant in this case that it was not done correctly by the court, or the findings were incomplete or not adequate in any way at all. So I think the two can exist side by side, but I think as a prevailing party, State Farm was entitled to those costs. I think on the, as far as the plaintiff's argument with regard to 1317-202, really it's just a question of doing the math. And until after this appeal was filed, the plaintiff persistently argued that the amount of the judgment exceeded the amount of the statutory offer settlement. And it was like a light bulb went on after the case was filed on appeal, and that's when plaintiffs tried to go back or try to get this court to remand so they go back to the trial court and increase the amount of the cost award. And that's simply not something that they're allowed to do. The plaintiff's attorney provided the court with a document that had two different numbers, a $12,000 number and an $18,000 number, as far as what were identified as pre-offer costs. The judge adopted or took the smaller of the number, the $12,000 number. But even if you had taken the higher of those two numbers and used the $18,000 number as the pre-offer cost in computing the amount of the judgment to compare with the offer settlement, the judgment amount still would have come in below $350,000. And plaintiffs recognize that. That's the reason they're trying to get it remanded so they can go back and basically get a fresh start with regard to costs.
Counsel, thank you very much. Your time is up. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.